Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. In this installment, we'll hear more of my conversation with Susan Rosenthal, MD, whose new book is Sick and Sicker. Here Susan explores the causes of our bad health, our bad healthcare system, and what we can do to make both better. I hope you'll stay tuned. A few shows back, we heard parts of a phone conversation I had on July 2 with Canadian healthcare activist Dr. Susan Rosenthal. Susan has just published Sick and Sicker, Essays on Class, Health, and Healthcare. You can buy this most interesting book in paperback from the author or as a Kindle electronic book from Amazon.com. For more information, please check out www.susanrosenthal.com. Chapter 2 of the book is a dialogue between Susan and Frederick Engels. You know, the co-author of the Communist Manifesto? Turns out that in 1845, Engels had published a very interesting book called The Condition of the Working Class in England. The conditions Engels describes are appalling. Could this be the direction we're now heading? From this, Susan goes on to show the problems in the Canadian healthcare system. Yes, it's much better than what we Yankees have, but it's all too similar in some respects, and it's far from good enough. Let's start with Engels.
The condition of the working class in England is especially important to me because I think it lays the foundation for medicine as a social science, and it positions Engels as the father of social medicine, that health really is rooted in social conditions. And many other of Engels' writings, they provide a really rich analysis that, for the most part, I think remains highly relevant today.
Mm-hmm. Tell our listeners some facts about the condition of the working class in England in the 1840s. I was stunned myself to find, for example, that the life expectancy of the rich, the nobility, the aristocracy, was only 30 years, and the life expectancy of the poor was around 15 years. And so just stunning, you know, and is this the direction we are heading today, back to something like that? Give us some more examples of what life was like for the working person back in what some people might think of falsely as the good old days.
The Industrial Revolution was a huge assault on the health and family structure of the people who came to work in the factories. Mm-hmm. But in the first place, these were primarily people who had been displaced from the land, and they were used to having family connections. Everyone pitched in and worked on the land, and that's how they survived. When they were torn up from the land, the enclosure movement made it very difficult, and the expropriation of land by the rich landowners, many of these peasants were forced into the cities and forced into the factories on threat of starvation. There were also laws against, you know, being out on the street, not having a job. So you were either in the factory, or you were in jail, or you were in the poorhouse, which was almost a death sentence in terms of the malnutrition. So people were forced into factories, working 18 hours a day or longer at all ages, children, young people. They were malnourished. They were overworked. There were huge number of accidents and injuries. The family structure was torn apart because who was looking after the children? Women, men, children, everybody in the factories. And so the child mortality skyrocketed. Epidemic diseases in the slums, human waste in the streets, there was no sanitation system, the houses were damp and moldy, people got tuberculosis, they died early. So it was a huge devastation. And far-sighted capitalists recognized that even though this was highly profitable in the short term, they were not going to be able to sustain this in the long run. And so they did join with working class organizations, and particularly the Chartist movement, to institute some social reforms. And yet still, as we talked about earlier, the working class continued to have poorer health than the middle and upper classes. And all the same problems that they had then, we have today. The class gradient in health, the issue of contaminated, adulterated food, which was a quick way to make a profit, the drugging of children in order to accommodate them to the lack of adult attention, the lack of a meaningful relationships with other people, to keep them quiet in a school system that is preparing them for the factory, the regimentation, and so forth. So in many ways, some of these problems we don't have to the same extent. However, many of them we do. For example, child labor. It continues to be a huge problem, even in the U.S. and Canada, and that's because families don't make enough to make ends meet. They have to put their children to work, especially in family-owned businesses, but also, you know, in agricultural settings. We also continue to have slavery, where workers are held captive. They're forced to work for no pay. For example, again, in agriculture, in sweatshops, we continue to have a widespread degradation of women, the lack of jobs that forces them into prostitution to support their families. We have half a million women dying every year in childbirth. This is totally unnecessary. We still have inadequate housing. We still have malnutrition. We have epidemic diseases. They had tuberculosis back then. We have HIV/AIDS. And we also have tuberculosis, which is making a comeback, certainly, in the homeless population of most cities. You have rampant tuberculosis. And we still have environmental pollution. Now, we don't have the choking industrial fog of London, for example, during the Industrial Revolution, which was from burning coal. But we have more invisible smog and carcinogenic compounds permeating the environment and rising the rate of cancer. So you might as well ask, has anything really changed in the last 150 years? The main difference between today and 150 years ago isn't that those problems have gone away. As you say, they continue to exist all over the world. The main difference is that today we have the knowledge, we have the technology, and we have the resources to solve all of these problems. But capitalism, with its profit motive, prevents us from doing so. That's the main difference.
160 years ago, they drugged children with laudanum to make them docile. Today we use Ritalin, but same process is going on. Like many Americans, I was envying the healthcare system in Canada, where you work, single-payer insurance, which for decades and decades and decades, you know, we haven't gotten anywhere near that point, and state-run hospitals. And then when I read your chapter, a couple chapters of your book, you go on to all the problems with the Canadian system, that healthcare is not being delivered well, people are not healthy, the for-profit aspect of medical care is growing. What's going on in Canada? And you know, is Rush Limbaugh and the AMA right? Is it true that socialized medicine doesn't work?
Well, Ken, in my chapter on the U.S. and Canada, different forms of medical rationing, what I point out is that in the United States, rationing takes a very obvious form, is that there are millions of people, tens of millions of Americans, who have no access to medical care. But we also have medical rationing in Canada. It takes a more subtle form in that people have to wait for care. And that's because the government isn't putting enough funding into the system. That kind of rationing, making everyone wait, is certainly much preferable to the kind of rationing that Americans suffer, because at least in Canada, you will get care. In the United States, you have no guarantee of getting care. In Canada, you have a guarantee of getting care. You may not get all the care you need, and you may not get it always in a timely fashion, but you will get it, at least at this point in time. So that's a huge benefit, and Americans are right to want to have a system similar to the Canadian system. However, the Canadian medical system is not socialized medicine. It's single payer, but the provision of medicine is in the private sector. Doctors are not government employees, not most of them. They are independent contractors. Also, the drug system, the pharmaceutical system, is totally in the private sector. Increasing sections of Canada's medical industry are in the private sector, like rehabilitation medicine, chronic care, physiotherapy, chiropractic.
Were they always in the private sector, or did they start out public and they've been privatized?
Some of them were never in the public sector. The drug industry was never in the public sector. Neither was dentistry, except for people on social welfare. Neither was optometry, eyeglasses, except for people on social welfare who had that basket of services. But what we've seen in the past 30 years is that cutbacks to the public system have meant that the private system has stepped in, not only in terms of insurance companies offering people coverage for what used to be covered, like eye examinations or chiropractic, but also services like physiotherapy, which were completely delisted. It used to be that if you went into the hospital, let's say you broke your leg, you would get free care in the hospital, and that is still the case, and you would then go to the hospital outpatient clinic for all your physiotherapy. Mm-hmm. The outpatient clinics were closed down, so now you have to go to a physiotherapy clinic outside the hospital, which is privately owned, and you have to pay out of pocket unless you have an insurance policy that will pay for you. So we are seeing more and more privatization. About 70% of Canada's health service is publicly financed, but 30% of it is privately financed. So there's not a huge amount of difference. Certainly single payer is better than multiple payer because you do eliminate a large amount of the bureaucracy. Canada provides more services to more people at half the cost of the United States. However, socialized medicine would mean that the provision of care would also be totally in the public sector, which means everything would be covered, all health workers would be employees of the government. This is the best we can hope for under capitalism.
And even that might not work. For example, that sounds like America's military hospitals and veterans hospitals, which are notorious for shortchanging the patients and delivering poor care.
That's because the examples of socialized medicine in the United States, like the Veterans Administration, deliver poor care because they're underfunded. And that's a question of social priority.
Mm-hmm.
Where you're putting the money. It's not that the money isn't there. There's trillions of dollars going to fight the wars in the Middle East. The only reason the Veterans Administration is underfunded is because it isn't being made a priority. If it was well-funded, it would be an excellent medical service, everyone getting care, top-notch professionals, and the best service. But still, even a socialized medical system is a system of damage control.
Mm-hmm.
And even when it's fully funded, it's still a system of damage control. And getting the government to fund public services is increasingly difficult because the system is in crisis, economic crisis. The only way that profitability can be sustained is by raiding the public treasury to subsidize banks, corporations, and so forth, and by pushing down the living standard of the working class. This is, by definition, going to make more people sick by increasing inequality, increasing deprivation, at the same time that you're cutting the social services and the safety net and the health services that would help keep people afloat.
So are you saying then that it's easy to imagine a system that's better than what the United States has now, and you have a better one in Canada, but we're still not going to get good health care, we're still not going to get good health unless capitalism is gotten rid of?
Essentially, that's true, because as long as the medical system is reacting only mm-hmm. to the damage caused by capitalism, it's not preventative, it's curative. The percent of our health industry that is devoted to public health is minuscule. It's less than 1%. That's not profitable. What's profitable is to put the money into curative medicine, drugs, surgeries, and medical testing. That's where the money is. So our medical system in Canada or the U.S. is distorted by what is profitable. And the less public funding that goes into it, the less public control there is in the medical system, the more the privatization and the for-profit priority distort the system. So what we really need is a system that's based on human need, a medical system that addresses environmental issues, workplace issues, issues of housing and food and childcare, of bigotry and racism and discrimination, a health system that really is about pulling people together to provide for human need. And that's basically a social society. And in any health system, in a good health system, the health system I would like to see, the people who work in it would be making the decisions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the nurses that I know, they know how many nurses there should be on the floor to provide optimal care. But they're not the ones who get to make that decision. That decision is made based on budget, on cost cutting, on cost efficiency, and so forth. So that's what a socialist society is. It's where the people who do the work make the decisions because they're in the position to know how to do it in the best way.
We're talking with Dr. Susan Rosenthal, author of Sick and Sicker, Essays on Class, Health, and Healthcare. In this final part, Susan discusses how the so-called computer revolution has enabled management to exploit workers even worse, including doctors and nurses, to say nothing of patients. We'll end on a note of hope, with a discussion of the great improvements in public health care in Chile during the presidency of Salvador Allende in the 1970s. Allende was no communist or even a socialist, and what he did, we could do.
You have a chapter of your book that deals with that issue directly, assembly line medicine. And in fact, you're talking about everything is going in the opposite direction. Workers are having less and less power. Control is being imposed from higher and higher up. You connect this with a classic work by Frederick Winslow Taylor. You connect it with the restaurant business and schools today. Can you make some of these connections for our listeners?
Yes, Ken. The drive to raise productivity, which is basically the drive to increase capital accumulation, is turning the entire society into an assembly line.
Mm-hmm.
And computers, the computer revolution, is central to that process. Now, I remember back in the late 60s, early 70s, when computers started to become a big deal, people were talking about how this was going to save labor and we were all going to have so much leisure time, we didn't know what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
That was going to be the biggest problem, what to do with all the time off. The robots would do all the difficult, dangerous, dirty work.
I remember
we would
that.
All be sitting back, mm-hmm. painting or dancing or inventing or doing whatever it is.
And then with nuclear right? power, with nuclear power, electricity will be so cheap they'll just throw away the meter.
Yeah, things like that, right?
Yeah.
And the potential of computers is in that direction. However, that's not the way capitalism has driven the process. It has used computers to basically gather information about the work process that people do,
mm-hmm.
so that that information can be brought into the hands of management and then re-engineered so that different parts of the process can be farmed out to different individuals, preferably the least skilled, least paid individuals. So, for example, they say, oh, you know, if we can give nurses and nurse practitioners these jobs and let doctors just do the jobs that they're really good at. So the work gets divided and fragmented, and if you can pay someone less and they don't need skill to do a particular part of it, then you do it. So it's a basic de-skilling process, and that's what we see. We see nurse practitioners replacing doctors, RNAs replacing RNs, personal service workers replacing practical nurses, and all of these people are being paid less rather than being paid more. So management is attempting to control every step of the work process, and they can only do that because of the information that computers give us. In terms of the health industry, this is really devastating. It means that there are all kinds of computerized mechanisms for determining, for example, where a nurse is at any particular time, how long it takes her to do any particular procedure. So all this information is fed into the computer, and the computer can use a complex algorithmic mm-hmm. program to find the outliers. For example, nurses who may not be doing as much might be spending more time with the patient than the average. So these people are singled out, and they're told, why are you spending so much time with your patients? Your colleagues are not spending that much time with their patients.
Hmm.
So it's a way of dividing workers, but also raising productivity. And if someone is doing more than someone else, the computer also picks that up, and then that becomes a new standard. Well, your colleague is doing these many tasks in such a time. Why can't you do it? So
mm-hmm.
the computers enable the process of getting more work out of each worker to be scientifically designed. And it also affects the patient care, because we now have what's called decision-making computer programs, where you plug in information about the patient, and then the computer decides, based on statistical data that has been gathered in the past, whether or not a treatment is likely to help that patient. And if the computer decides it isn't, the patient doesn't get the treatment, even though that particular patient actually might benefit from that treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if that patient who doesn't get the treatment then dies, then that is fed back into the computer, and the computer says, well, see, that person wouldn't have benefited. So it becomes a self-serving, self-perpetuating system.
Mm.
I'm going to give you an example
okay.
of something that recently came to my attention, and that was about screening for cervical cancer in women. Now, it has been the policy in Canada to basically screen all women of reproductive age and older every 2 to 5 years, depending on their age, for cervical cancer. It's not an expensive test. It's generally done by a doctor, and it's fairly reliable. Well, now there's a new policy, And the new policy is based on a computer analysis of the cost of screening women over 70 versus the cost of treating them for cervical cancer. Computer determined that age 70 was the point at which the cost of screening outweighed the cost of treatment, and therefore they are no longer going to pay for pap smears for women over 70. So if you are unlucky enough to fall outside the statistical norm and be a woman over 70 who gets cervical cancer, it will not be detected because you will not be getting a pap smear. That's how decisions are being made, not on what do people need, but on what is considered cost-effective for the system. And what is considered cost-effective for the system is basically the least amount of cost. And if people have to die, well, too bad.
There is an encouraging note in your book. In the last chapter, you talk about health reforms that Chile instituted in the 70s under Allende. Ultimately, they were reversed after Allende was ousted. But you seemed impressed and pleased by a number of things that they tried in Chile. And presumably, we could try here. Chile did not have a communist revolution by any means, and Allende, I don't even know if you call him a socialist. But they were able to make some good reforms in their system until they got overthrown. Can you tell us about what did Chile do? And your chapter's titled The Lessons of Chile. What are the lessons we can draw from Chile?
You're quite right. Salvador Allende was not a communist or a socialist. He made that very clear. He was a social democrat, and his aim was to bring some reforms into the system that would reduce inequality and benefit the people as a whole. One of the main reforms was to nationalize the copper industry, and another was to expand the public health service. This was a huge benefit to the population, in which inequality was very great. So putting more resources into a milk program for children, clinics for children, for child health, maternal health, expanding the hours that these clinics would be open, really did raise the standard of living and the standard of health of the poorest people, particularly in the major cities. Also, in addition to expanding the service, was to attempt to democratize the medical service, to give patients, families, communities, and health workers more say in how the social resources would be used. And this wasn't just tell us what you want and we'll do what we want to do anyway. There was a real attempt to respond to the needs of people on the ground and who were working in the service and who had the first-hand information about where it was lacking and what was and wasn't working.
How did the medical establishment respond to these changes? Were they more progressive than our own?
Oh, yes. This is what was very interesting, is that while the public health service and the public doctors in the public health were really on board with all of this, the Chilean Medical Association was furious because they were a very conservative organization. They liked things the way they were. Chile's medical system was highly class stratified. You had what Navarro calls Rolls Royce or Cadillac medicine for the people at the top, and then less and less as you went down. And the rich people and the Chilean Medical Association, who these rich people were connected with, they didn't want to reduce the emphasis on Cadillac medicine in order to provide more basic medicine for a broader number of people. And it's true whenever you reduce inequality that the people at the top have to get along with less in order for everyone else to get a lot more. So they really did not want to lose any of their privileges. And they fought, the Chilean Medical Association fought Allende's reforms all the way down the line. They castigated him. They even expelled him from the Chilean Medical Association, even though he had been a founding member of it. They conspired with the generals, it turned out later, and they were the first to congratulate them when they overthrew this democratically elected government. So the coup, which was hatched in Washington because the Chilean democratic movement was a threat to the whole region and U.S. control over the region, especially the nationalization of the copper industry. They didn't want that to spread. So this military coup was instigated and the president was murdered. Thousands of people were rounded up and killed. Huge repression for many, many years.
That's when they put in Pinochet.
And that was Pinochet who headed that military coup against the government. So the brutality of the repression was directly in relationship to the threat that Chile represented, is that ordinary working people were getting a sense that they had rights, that they had basic rights. More than that, that they had the ability to take charge of certain aspects of the economy and run them for human need, like the health service. There are some very positive things that came out of that experience. And one is that health workers really do have a central role to play in democratizing the health system and creating a health system that does respond to human need. That's the positive part of that. It's possible to build a mass movement for that with health workers playing a central role. Some of the other lessons is that you can never underestimate the extent to which the capitalist class will go to defend their privileges and their system. And the other thing is that you cannot eliminate class divisions in medicine without also eliminating them in society. I think when it comes to the medical system, Americans ask for way too little. We have to raise our sights of what is possible. That is so important. When I was at the U.S. Social Forum, I was talking to a fellow who was part of a single-payer coalition fighting for single-payer, which is what most Americans want. Certainly would be an improvement. And I said, well, you really need to fight for socialized medicine. And he said, oh, I don't know that people would go for that. You know, it's like we have to go for something. We have to raise the demand for something people would actually get behind. I said, I don't agree with you. The vast majority of Americans, according to all the polls, want national Medicare. They want a system that covers everyone, provides everyone with basic care. That's very clear. If you fight for socialized medicine, you might get single payer. You know, if you fight for the bakery, you might get a loaf. If you fight for a loaf, you might get a slice. If you fight for a slice, you might get a bite. If you fight for a bite, you might get crumbs. But if you only fight for crumbs, all you get is a kick in the butt. Right? You have to go,
is that a Canadian proverb, or did you make that up on the spot?
No, that's what I told him. And I said, you know, we have to go for the whole banana in order to get anything. Because the only reason that we get reform is to buy us off from going for revolution. It's not about the justness of the cause. It's not about the common sense of the cause. That is very clear. When you talk about single payer, it's a much better system than what you have now in the United States. But in spite of it being more logical, more economic, and so forth, it will not be won unless the ruling class is afraid that the majority is going to replace them. That's the only way you're going to get such a major reform. And the fight for single payer didn't show that level of confidence and combativity that would frighten the ruling class into delivering such a reform. I mean, that's how the National Health Service was won in Britain. Because, as one of the lords said, if you don't give the people reform, they'll give you revolution.
Thanks for listening. For more information on the book Sick and Sicker, check out www.susanrosenthal.com. See also newworldnotes.blogspot.com. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of the University of Hartford. Illegitimi non carborundum, and ciao.